Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Does It Fit the Bill, the Impact of ACA on STD Programs session. If that's not the one you intended to be in, please stay anyway. I'm sure that we're going to hear some very interesting presentations. The impact of policy is something after my own heart, so welcome. So first up, we have Dr. Philip Chan, who will be presenting on the impact of the Affordable Care Act on insurance coverage and billing at a publicly funded STD clinic.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here. I serve as the consultant medical director of the Rhode Island Department of Health for their Office of HIV STDs. I'm also director of the STD clinic in Providence, Rhode Island, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. And I'm also work at Brown University as well as assistant professor there. So Rhode Island, the smallest state in the nation, and has a population of about 1.1 million people. With implementation of the ACA, we now have one of the lowest uninsured rates in the country. The estimates put it at less than 5%, and I've seen even lower estimates than that. Within Rhode Island, again, very small state, we essentially have one major urban center, and that's Providence. Providence accounts for over 80% of all STD diagnoses in and around Providence there, and it's also the site of the main STD clinic in the city. The STD clinic was started in 2012. At that time, as many of you know, for the trends across the country, we were seeing increasing STDs in many places, including our own. Our clinic initially opened as a clinic to provide free services, especially to gay, bisexual, and other men who have sex with men. About 30% of our population identifies as MSM, and our STD rate is greater than 15%, and much higher among MSM in general. We do provide free HIV STD testing to everyone that comes in if they can't pay and don't have insurance. And we've also implemented recently the ability to prescribe PrEP as well as PEP out of the clinic. What I want to talk about today is how implementation of ACA has really impacted our delivery of services at the STD clinic. So historically, when our clinic opened, we actually offered the ability for patients to use their insurance if they wanted to. So essentially, we asked people if they'd be willing to allow us to use their insurance for laboratory testing only. Our STD clinic is located on-site at our HIV clinic. It's sort of on top on the second floor, which means that we have the infrastructure to bill. I know that some public STD clinics don't have that, but we do have that infrastructure at our clinic. The goals of the current project that I'm talking about today is how we've been moving towards a model for billing for STD services, not just labs, but as well as medical provider time. And the reason for this is that now in our state and others across the country, the Affordable Care Act has led to a much higher proportion of people who are insured. So the question is, how do we utilize implementation of the ACA, Medicaid expansion, to start to think about reimburse our STD services? The first thing that we want to look at is barriers that exist to using existing insurance. So when patients come into our STD clinic, everyone completes a one-page intake. We ask basically the basic variables that the CDC asks, requests, things like demographics, behaviors, how many sex partners you've had in the last 12 months. What we did for the last 6 months of 2015 is that we asked another one-page questionnaire that asked about insurance status. Specifically, we asked whether their insurance was a result of the ACA, if they'd be willing to use it today, and what other barriers there were as a result to STD testing. What we found is this. Despite in our state of over 95% of people being insured, our STD clinic was still capturing a very large uninsured population. 40% of everyone who came to our STD clinic still reports being uninsured. People who were more likely to be uninsured are people that were older than 20, and that's because most of the people younger than 20 were still on their parents' insurance. Other uninsured people tended to be non-white, including Hispanic Latino, which I think, as many of you know, coincides with social determinants of health. And interestingly, non-MSM were more likely to be uninsured. So in fact, MSM were more likely to be insured in our state, likely representing a little bit of a higher socioeconomic status. Reasons of those 40% of people for not having insurance, the number one reason, close to 100% of people, and you could choose more than one answer, was not being able to afford it. Other answers included being unemployed, haven't had time, unable to know how to apply for it, or waiting for benefits from a new job. What's interesting is that, of course, many of you know, in Medicaid, being unemployed, you can have easy access to a lot of health care, so that should not be a reason. Among the people that were uninsured, 27% of those insured obtained coverage through the Affordable Care Act. 55% of those were previously uninsured. So we did see a significant pickup, even in our STD clinic population, of those who were helped through the ACA. The insurances that we do see, again, being a small state, we have a very limited number of insurers. The two big insurers are Blue Cross Blue Shield and United Healthcare, which account for that fraction of insurance there. Neighborhood Health Plan is a Medicaid service provider, as well as Medicaid there. So the majority of our patients who are insured are actually private insurance. And those are the options that we have through our local insurance exchange. Of people that were insured, we asked them why they did not want to use their insurance for STD testing. By far and away, the number one reason was that they wanted to remain anonymous. And this is something that we've seen time and time again. Other people didn't want their parents or guardians to receive an invoice, didn't want their partners to receive an invoice. We do have a lot of men who are having sex with men that may be married or have female partners that haven't disclosed to them their sexual orientation or behaviors. Out of everyone of our clinic that visited during that time period, 23% of people actually used their insurance to bill for laboratory testing. So a little bit less than a quarter of people actually used their insurance. However, 40% of people said that they would be willing to use their insurance, and that is of those insured. The second question that we wanted to ask is, as I mentioned, that we currently bill, if people let us, for laboratory services. We are starting to implement a system now where we've hired a couple of physician's assistants, and we want to start to reimburse for provider time as well. So the question that we wanted to ask next was, as we move towards more of a fee-for-service system, what percent of patients do we actually have to bill for services in order to make, in order to break even? Again, we're not looking for a profit, but we want our STD clinic to be sustainable. That will also give us some flexibility in adding on additional services. So we performed a cost analysis. We looked at different costs of the STD clinic. This includes the salaries for one physician assistant, one nurse, two counselors, and one secretary, and this is basically the setup of our current STD clinic. We also accounted for equipment, medications for treatment, bicillin, ceftriaxone, azithromycin, as well as for lab tests, HIV, syphilis, gonorrhea, and chlamydia. And then we also looked at income, our ability to bill for labs, our ability to bill for provider time as well. When we look at the cost breakdown of our STD clinic, the majority of our lab costs actually go to lab testing. These tests are incredibly expensive. I'll show you on the next slide some of the costs at our institution, with about a third dedicated to salary costs, and you can see that supply costs, supply meaning like gauze and band-aids and needles, is a minor fraction. This is the list price of STD testing at our institution. Again, this may vary by institution. I asked our institution if they were okay if I published these results, and they surprisingly said yes, so here they are. So the HIV test, the actual cost of running a fourth generation HIV test at our institution is $1.21. We run the non-treponemal RPR test. The cost at our institution to do that is 37 cents. And the cost for NAT testing, gonorrhea and chlamydia testing, is $13.68 per test. So I will remind you, if any of you are doing extragenital testing, that's $13.68 per test times three if you're doing other sites as well. The Medicaid fee schedule, which is publicly available online, reimburses institutions at these rates. And the list cost at our institution is if you were to pay out of pocket is stated here. A lot of our lab tests are automated. It's a very large hospital laboratory system that deals with a lot of the state, but you can see there's significant markup and also significant difference between what the list price is and the Medicaid price. What I did not have access to, which I tried to get, is the private insurance reimbursement. The reason for that is that even if you look at some of our major insurers, Blue Cross Blue Shield, they have multiple insurance plans with multiple reimbursement rates, so it's tough to get an exact average quantity for that. What I will tell you, though, is that private insurance reimbursement rates will fall between the Medicaid as well as the list price. In terms of billing for provider time, when a doctor, some of you may know this, but a lot of you may not, when you bill for provider time, these are the specific codes that you use. So if you're a new patient, the first five levels of codes are used there. For a follow-up visit, you can bill for the second five levels there. It's based on time as well as your note. You can see that if I saw you as a new patient for a level one billing, we would bill you $83. That would be out of pocket. Medicaid would only reimburse me $16.72. Again, private insurance would reimburse somewhere in the middle. And you can see that goes all the way up to approximately, for a level five visit, 60 minutes, $450 or $46 reimbursement through Medicaid. You can also see why now a lot of doctors in general are not accepting Medicaid because of the low reimbursement rates, and why it's much more lucrative for doctors in general not to accept Medicaid. For purposes of STD services, we have talked about generally billing at a level two or a level three for new patients when they come in. You can see that we'd be reimbursed about $27, $29 depending on that. For follow-up visits, we imagine billing at a level two or level three, and recouping about $20 for Medicaid billing. These are generally the levels that are billed for most of these services. About a level three is average. What that means is that when we look at the cost of our STD clinic in 2015, so we saw about 2,100 patients in 2015, the estimated cost of running our STD clinic, which I will mention runs Wednesday, Thursday, Friday afternoons only, but during that time, the cost of our clinic is estimated to have been around $173,000. The reason why the word adjusted is there is because we did assume that everyone receives one of each STD test, so that would be one HIV, one syphilis, one gonorrhea, one chlamydia. Some people that come in, of course, don't get all those testings for various reasons, and some people, we do routinely do extragenital testing as well. So the cost for this may be slightly higher than that. But assuming that the adjusted cost is around accurate, what you can see here is the blue line is that if everyone who came into the clinic was billed for labs and billed to Medicaid only, we would have to essentially bill every single person who came into clinic to break even. If we started billing for labs as well as provider time at around a level three, we would have to bill around 1,500 of those 2,000 patients in order to break even. Again, the list price is significantly more lucrative. You can see that if we were billing for labs and time based on the list price of an institution, which no one ever reimburses that we would have to bill around 300 patients to recoup the costs of our STD clinic. The private insurance, which again I do not have the numbers for, would fall somewhere in the middle. So the conclusions based on our work are that STD clinics still provide an important safety net, even in Medicaid expansion states. As you saw, there's still a significant number of people that we provide services to who are uninsured, despite the high levels of insurance coverage. And even for patients who are insured, significant barriers still exist to using insurance, and these include cost sharing, like co-pays and deductibles, and the desire to remain anonymous. And I would not underestimate that, and that's something that I've had to talk with different hospital administrators who want us to start registering people and in getting all their contact information. I've told them that if we start to do that, it's going to turn away a significant proportion, if not majority, of our patients at the STD clinic. Our other conclusion is that Medicaid reimbursement alone will not be able to sustain our STD clinic. Even if we build everyone at the maximum level for Medicaid, we're still going to barely break even. And again, given that a lot of our patients are uninsured and there's other barriers to testing, billing Medicaid alone will not result in sustainable STD clinic services. Bottom line is really we need a mix of private and public payers. Future directions, my last slide here. We're actually starting to bill provider time next week, so we're going to see how that goes. We're going to have a very robust system where we capture who is being charged and who isn't. And the deal I've worked out with our hospital administrators is that people who allow us will be registered into our electronic medical system. We will continue our paper-based system for capturing behaviors and demographics, because we do not want that scanned into the electronic medical record. Patients will be asked whether we can use their insurance. If they say no, we will provide it for free. Importantly, for point six, if a patient receives a large deductible in the mail, they're able to bring it in and our hospital system will waive it. The argument that I made with our hospital institution is that if you show up in January and you have a $1,000 deductible, it's beneficial for us to waive that fee so that they'll come back, you know, in April, August, where we'll be able to bill the insurance companies for the services subsequently, and that eating that cost in January is beneficial to overall financial stability. The other thing that we do is that all patients who do test positive and we treat with the medication due to medical liability, we do have to enter them into our medical system. So there's really no way around that. Before we give antibiotics, the possibilities of anaphylactic reactions, we do want to make sure that we have clear documentation. I do want to acknowledge our funders. We did receive a small C grant from ASSO, it's the CDC, for help with this. They've been invaluable in this work. Also, certainly Rhode Island Department of Health, the Rhode Island Public Health Institute, led by Amy Nunn, and our hospital partner, the Merriam Hospital. So thank you very much. Happy to answer any questions. Couple minutes for questions.
I'm Susan Carter with East Carolina University. And for your STD clinic, are you having any difficulty in obtaining contracts from insurance companies to provide, to get your providers credentialed, since you're not offering a full range of services that most often, you know, include primary care and that?
So we operate on a fee-for-schedule service at the moment, so that has not been an issue. We are part of our larger HIV clinic, so it hasn't been an issue. One thing that we are looking at, though, is to work more towards value-based payments, because giving one of the issues, my argument is that we are treating a lot of people with insurance. We are treating a lot of Blue Cross Blue Shield customers for free. Blue Cross Blue Shield, in my opinion, should be giving us some reimbursement for that, and that's a conversation that we're trying to gently broach with the insurance companies.
John Ellen Johns Hopkins. Do you have any sense that for a non-Medicaid expanding state, how much worse the insurance would have been, coverage would have been in your clinic? So if you took the people who were single men, for example, that would have, who had Medicaid from expansion, they wouldn't have been covered in my beautiful state of Florida. So do you have any sense of that?
Yeah, I think it's worse. It's difficult for me to quantify. Perhaps we could ask the gentleman right behind you who runs the Mississippi STD clinic, Dr. Mina.
There you go, Matt.
That's a really great question. You know, it's really interesting, and that was my question. You know, Mississippi has a Medicare waiver for family planning, and since January 2015, the Medicare waiver now includes men. So we've been starting to enroll any men who is younger than 43 years old who has not had a vasectomy in the Medicaid waiver. And one thing that I have learned by doing that is that about 30% of people who say they are uninsured who come to the clinic actually happen to have insurance. And my question for you was, so overall, you know, about 40% of our patients who receive, you know, PrEP services, for example, are uninsured, 45%. But my question for you is that, do you rely on self-report or not having insurance, or you verify that they actually did not have insurance?
So that's a great question. So as I mentioned, we have an intake form where we actually ask about insurance. That's been given out to everyone since the beginning of time at our STD clinic, 2012. We have this anonymous survey that we gave out for that six-month period. That also asks the exact same question. We actually found a significant difference between our intake forms and that anonymous survey. So the people on their anonymous survey were truthful, and they said, a lot more said they had insurance than was captured on our intake form. So I think that this data is probably accurate, and there was a statistically significant difference than what we collected on our normal clinical intake form. So I think it's probably more accurate. Are some people lying? Maybe.